Today, I want to continue the discussion on government. And I want to, the topic is entirely independent of the other discussion, except for the fact that we are going to deal with some aspect of government. And I want to talk about government and income, taxes, and poverty. I have to put the word taxes in there because that's what Walt said it would be. I'm not sure. We're exactly to the point of taxes yet. But anyway, so that's what it will be. I'd also been admonished to introduce myself, and I'm Jan Hansen. I teach economics at Capital University, which is in Columbus, Ohio. It's an ALC school, just to get the plug in. In case any of you have students in the vicinity that you'd like to send to us. Okay, so government and income, taxes and poverty. The central question that I want to deal with is, how can government affect the distribution of income? And I want to limit the discussion to distribution of income in the United States, okay, which is then just another way of saying, what can we, or what can the government do about poverty? Okay, and I want to begin by telling you what or how I'm going to proceed, and I've just said I'm going to try to do five things. First, I want to describe our nation's distribution of income. You know, sort of just try using figures to describe what it's like. Secondly, I want to explore the reasons for that particular distribution. My conclusion is that there is poverty, and I want to explore why poverty. And third, I want to justify, economically at least, some of the social action programs that we have to try to alleviate the poverty situation. So I want to justify, and I do that economically only because that's sort of only the area where I feel I have any kind of qualification or expertise at all. So maybe you can bring some of the other justifications for social action programs into it. And fourth, I want to explore some alternative redistribution programs that we are currently using. And then finally, I want to evaluate the results of our efforts at redistribution or at eliminating poverty. That is, I want to see if the government programs that we have instituted have done any good at all. When we were here Tuesday, we talked a little bit about government and the justification for government, and we said there were three reasons why governments should exist. One was to protect property rights. The second was to provision public goods, you know, national defense, police and fire protection, that sort of stuff. And then third, to help in the allocation of resources, which are subject to externalities. You know, by externalities, we mean pollution, that sort of stuff. And we didn't talk very much about that. And an example of that would be the chemical plant upstream, which pollutes water, okay, for the town's drinking water downstream. What tends to happen is that the chemical plant doesn't really then have to pay the full cost of production of its product because it's allowed to pollute the stream and not to clean it up. Okay, that tends to cause that plant to have lower costs. If they have lower costs, they have lower prices, and if they have lower prices, they tend to overproduce. So we say then, unless somehow or other you can force that plant to pay the cost of the full cost of their operation, we will tend to overutilize resources. Okay. So the government then steps into this process. Okay, so that's the third major justification for government intervention then, is where you have externalities. They help alleviate sort of the process of allocation. Okay. So that, and I just wanted to mention that because we didn't spend a whole lot of time on that one last time. Okay. None of these points of justification for government have mentioned anything at all about what the government should do about the distribution of income, how we should fairly distribute income. There's nothing at all in there about sort of economic or social justice. And what can and should the government do about that kind of economic or social justice? And I think that government is organized to hear people express their values regarding justice, regarding fairness, regarding equities. And these values that people have, I think, come out of entirely different system than the actual distribution of income that we have. I'm trying to say that the market provides us with an income distribution. Our economic system gives us a given income distribution. Okay. Yet we have sets of values which are based, I suppose, to some extent on our moral and religious beliefs. Okay. And those are different. Those values that we have are different than what the market system provides in the way of an income distribution. So there is a discrepancy between what the income distribution is and what we think the income distribution ought to be. You know, does that come across? Our ethical system come out of an entirely different set of circumstances than does the actual distribution that we have. Okay. And this is what we have to grapple with. Our political system, to some extent, ought to be able to deal with that. In other words, we ought to be able to vote for the people that will fix the income distribution so that it's fair in accordance with our ethical system. Because there is clearly a difference between what we think should be and what actually exists. Okay, and it's kind of that question, that difference then, that I want to attempt to get at today. There is a whole nother point. You know, the discussion could go in two directions now, and there is this another direction which I just want to briefly mention and then drop and then get back to the income distribution. And that is, as I was sitting there thinking about what I was going to say today, I thought that when we decide how to settle public issues, you know, for instance, let's take something like national defense. Okay, there is quite a bit of public oratory about national defense, about yay, rah-rah, United States. We ought to protect the country for the sake of the citizens and so on. And then I started reflecting on our own representative in Congress, Samuel Devine, who is probably one of the 20 most conservative men in Congress. You know, so conservative that conservatism gets in his way. Yeah. And I keep thinking that, you know, when he really votes, does he decide on what's good for the country? Or does he decide on what's sort of in his self-interest to do? You know, and it's clear that his decision is based on how he can get reelected, what he thinks is good, what will benefit the people in his districts and so on. And it probably disregards the national welfare largely. Now, it's going to, you know, if we have an air base outside of Columbus, you know, that's going to help the country somewhat. But probably not as much as if we have that air base and all the money spent for that air base in some more strategically located place. You know. But that should be Samuel Devine's concern, but that isn't Samuel Devine's concern. So there's a lot of self-interest that goes into this. That same kind of self-interest also crops, you know, sort of continually crops up in our poverty types of programs and so on. Well, anyway, we could take the discussion along those lines, but I want to do it slightly different. And the first thing I want to do is try to describe the income distribution. There was a blackboard here this morning that I was going to use, but it isn't here now, so you're going to have to picture these figures in your mind, and I'll try to sort of limit them. But for instance, in 1965, okay, 15 million families in the United States had income less than 5,000. That was one-third of our population at that time, roughly speaking. 31%, 15 million families had income less than $5,000. 43% of the families, or 21 million people, had incomes between 5 and 10,000. Okay. Only 18% had income between $10,000 and $15,000, and so what is left? 7%, roughly 7, 8% had income above $15,000. Okay. In 1975, which is the latest figures I was able to get a hold of, that income distribution had changed so that 15% of the people had income greater than $25,000. 32% had income above between $15,000 and $25,000. So let me just add up here. 47% compared to 7% had income greater than $15,000. Okay. Only 10% of the people had income less than $5,000 compared with 31% in 1965. Okay, so if you look at those kinds of absolute family income statistics or data, it appears that we have done quite a bit, that we've almost had miraculous income redistribution. Now, yes?
Are those constant value dollars?
Now, that's exactly the point. They are not constant dollars or constant value dollars. It's $1965 dollars for 1965 and $1975 dollars for 1975 and what has happened in the meantime? Inflation. Yeah. Inflation between 67 and 79 prices, between 67 and 78 prices have doubled, you know. So roughly speaking, between 65 and 75 prices have doubled. You know, that means that even though median family income, you know, the by median, the midpoint, even though median family income has gone from 7,065 to 14,375, people in the average are worse off today than they were in 1965 for two reasons. As you mentioned, inflation, prices have doubled. And the second important reason, which has sort of crept up and we haven't paid much attention to it, is the tax structure. You know, what happens as our taxes go up or as our income goes up? You know, we keep moving from one income tax bracket into another, you know. And the income tax structure, the bracketed structure, has not changed since about 1961, okay? So that means then the average income in 1975 or 1965, which was around 7,000, was in a very low income tax bracket, probably what we call the 16-17% bracket. Okay. The average income in 1975, 14,000, is probably very close to the 21st percent bracket, see? So we're paying a significantly higher income tax today on the same dollar value income, okay? And the agency that's getting rich is sort of the government in this process. You know, the government hasn't really, you know, we've had some problems with deficits. But if income keeps rising and inflation keeps rising at the rate it's going and income attempts to match it, you know, there are some people that speculate that we will eliminate the deficit naturally by about 1981, 82, you know, and Carter won't even have to do anything about it. It's just the fact that the government will generate more revenue because incomes will go up, unless, in the meantime, we change the income tax structure. And it's very hard to change the income tax structure in the country. So, you know, we're not very apt to get very much about that.
It's difficult because of what, lobbyists or special interests, or it's so complicated, or why is that so tough? I mean, they're supposedly having, you know, these hearings on income taxes and things like that. Why is that so tough?
All of the reasons you mentioned. Thank special you. Interest groups, you know, lobbying groups that would like to preserve their loopholes, you know, that sort of stuff. And we all have loopholes, you know. We have a loophole which has to do with tuition remission. I teach at a university, and our children get tuition remission, you know, which is a significant amount of money. That income that I get, or tuition remission, is not taxable income. It's a loophole, you know. And so our administration told us to write, they were threatening to take that away from us, and so our administration wrote and told us to lobby to keep that. And my tactic, you know, was I wanted to close that loophole, so I wrote and asked them to do just the opposite, you know, to close the loophole. you know, which they didn't do, you know, because people in their selfish interest, you know, overwhelmingly wanted to keep that loophole. See, and I knew that, you know, so I could slap myself on the back and said I did what was good for the country, you know, when I knew damn well that nothing really would change because so many other people would do just the opposite.
Well, clergymen have a similar loophole with housing.
Sure.
Thing.
Yeah. What about the no property taxes on the churches?
Yeah, that's another big loophole.
Think if church property were taxed.
Yeah, I'd have a little more problem, you know, with that one. Income-producing property of churches is something separately from property that the churches own, which is not used for income creation, non-income creating property. You know, so the church building proper itself, I probably don't think should be taxed. The upheaval would be so tremendous, you know. But if the church owns a block downtown, which is used for commercial purposes, I think it probably should be taxed. You know. But that's a whole nother kind of forum. Well, anyway, so it looks like we've done some tremendous things with income redistribution, but we probably haven't. And at least if you look at constant dollars. Okay. There's also something interesting about the composition of the income distribution. You know, I've spewed off all these percentages and so on. The composition is very interesting to look at least I think so. based on that income distribution and what we call the poverty level, which is roughly around $4,800 to $5,200, depending on whose figures you use, okay, there are roughly speaking 25 million poor people in the United States, which is what? Probably 12% of our population currently.
You mean people living under the poverty level?
Yeah, living under the poverty level, which is what we call them, you know, poor.
That includes students and everything.
Yeah, that's right.
That figure's no good.
Yeah, and it includes some other distortions as well. There are some, and you know, we'll pick up on some of the reasons. but what is kind of interesting is that 25% of those poor, see now, so relatively these figures are going to be right. You know, in absolute terms, we may quibble about whether it should be 25% or 25 million or 20 million. But relatively speaking, the proportions are going to be the same. 25% of the poor are non-white. Okay, and the non-whites make up what? 12-15% of the population? Am I correct in that? Does anybody know? So there is a disproportionate number of non-whites, minorities in the poor. 12% of the poor are over age 65. And about 48% of the poor are in families that are headed by female. Now, the significance of that is that in the labor market, females are discriminated against, and there's very little probability that these people, through their own productivity, can sort of dig themselves out of this poverty trap they're in. So we have to conclude that poverty does exist in the United States. We may not necessarily agree with the straight figures, but it does exist. And I think there are four economic explanations for why poverty exists. And the first one has to do with some of the poor people are poor simply because they have low productivity. They just don't have the skills, the training, and the education necessary to fit into jobs which provide sufficient income. They are low productivity types of people. As a consequence, they can only be, or employers can only afford to pay them a low wage, and hence, you know what, we're kind of trapped in this type of a situation, because you can't really give somebody who produces $2 worth of goods per hour a $5 wage. You know, that's just kind of antithetical to our sort of capitalistic structure. What's worse is that longitudinal studies, you know, studies have been conducted following these poor, okay, longitudinally over time, and it turns out that sort of a vicious poverty cycle is created. Okay, the head of the family is poor. Okay, the habits that individual has, the motivation that individual has, is instilled in the next generation. They mimic that kind of lifestyle and also tend to be then poor. It's a remarkable sort of high percentage of poor come from poor families. And these studies where we follow them, now we're now beginning to talk about fourth generation people in poverty on welfare and so on. So that's a tremendous problem that we have to deal with. Education, who is it, Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson, who has sort of now come around. He's on a big push for education, because in the United States we reward education with higher levels of income. And it doesn't matter whether the education is necessary to do the job or not, it's the screening device that we use. And, you know, it's rational, economically rational to do that. Wouldn't you do that? If you had no other way of ascertaining whether or not an individual would do a job, what would you do? You would go and check and see if they finished grade school or if they finished high school. Chances are, if they've done that, they'll probably be able to do the job. And so there's a big push to educate people, not in an attempt to make them any better, you know, but in an attempt to have them pass the screening hurdle which the employers use. Okay, so that the first reason then has to do with the low productivity of the people. The second reason is really discrimination. Racial and sexual. Okay. Many of the poor are non-white. Many of the poor are females. And it's clear that we use race and sex, okay, as a measure, yeah, and age. I should include that. Race, sex, and age as a measure of potential productivity, and in this way eliminate a lot of people from entering the job market. Now, some economic studies have been done on this, and what the economic studies indicate is not very nice. It's not a nice picture. What we tend to say is that employers discriminate against blacks, against older people, and against females because the rest of the population have a taste for discrimination. Have a desire to discriminate. It's been shown, and these are attitudinal studies, so I'm kind of threading now on some psychological ground which I'm not really sure about. I know the economic implications of this, but white people simply don't want to work with black people. I will only work in a situation where there are black people if I get a higher wage. Now, what is the employer going to do? The employer is going to prevent paying that higher wage. Okay, and how is he going to do that? By discriminating against black. Because it's been shown that white people will work at a lower wage if there aren't any blacks around. Or perhaps more accusatory, is they will only work with black people if there is a compensating higher wage. So hence we say then that white people have a taste for discrimination. Yes. And that forces then some people into black people into lower paying jobs. There are clearly two types of labor markets. We refer to one of those labor markets as a primary labor market and the other as a secondary labor market. The characteristics of that secondary labor market are dead-end jobs, high quit rates, very, very high turnover of jobs, low upward mobility, you know, all of those things. And the primary market, of course, is the opposite. You know, primarily white-collar jobs, high upward mobility, high wages, that sort of stuff. And a disproportionate number of blacks are in, and females, and older people, are in that secondary labor market. And it isn't the case in the United States that people who can pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. You know, those two labor markets have been proven to be discontinuous. That is, you don't jump from the primary market when you reach the top of that, or you don't jump from that secondary market. When you reach the top of that secondary market, you don't jump into that primary market and work your way up. You're just bumping up against the ceiling of job capability or job availability in that primary or in that secondary market, and it's very, very hard to transfer out of that market into the other. And so then the people that are discriminated against get discouraged, they quit, they become accused of being lazy bums, they don't want the jobs. Gee, look at that guy, he held four jobs in a year. You know, he can't be any good. You know, how many of us here would want those types of jobs? How many of us wouldn't get discouraged and quit if all we could do was to work for the minimum wage continually? And there was no possibility, or at least there seemingly there was no possibility to sort of get out of that crummy job market that we're in. There is clearly labor market segmentation in the United States. We have separate markets for separate types of people.
But Jan, there's another reason for that secondary labor market, and that's the fact that so many people can draw more money out of the system than they can working in those low-paying jobs.
Yeah, that to some extent has altered, you know, has changed the labor market structure to some extent. Although, see, you know, we tend to look at that, assistance for jobs, which very clearly makes people, or gives people more options. You know, you don't have to take the first job that you want. If you're unemployed, you clearly don't have to accept the first job offer you get, which may be a low one. You can just sort of hang around and wait because you know you'll get 60% of your salary through some kind of government compensation. But what has tended what we tend to do is look at that compensation from the government in the states where there's really good compensation. For instance, Michigan has very, very high compensation. But for every Michigan you have four states with very lousy compensation. You know, in Michigan, you can get on the average up to about 60-70%. In the automobile industry, you can get 92% of your salary in unemployment compensation, union benefits, and company benefits, that sort of stuff. But that's, you know, the Michigan is the exception. There are some other states that have fairly good types of unemployment compensation, but the majority do not. So that it isn't
more about public assistance through the welfare agencies, though, than I was unemployment. The fact that you were saying that there are so many, particularly women, in the secondary labor market, they would rather stay on public assistance, whether it's ADC or whatever. They can draw more from that and still be with their children.
Yeah, and some people, that was developed because some people clearly thought that's where women, head of families, belong. You know, the aid to families with dependent children, one of the economic justifications for that was that mothers ought to be home. And the majority of ADC isn't the father motherless type of family. It's really a mother fatherless family, and the children receive assistance then. And the reason why the mother stays home is that her income is taxed so heavily if she does work. You know, for instance, you can get $4,800 in compensation or welfare payment without working. But if you do work and you earn, say, $2,000 a year, the compensation you receive in terms of welfare is reduced by $2,000. You know, it's almost that steep. What's the tax rate on the money you've earned? 100%. Every bit of the $2,000 then you earned is taxed away from you. And there isn't anybody else that pays a tax rate of 100%. So we've kind of built that incentive into it. yeah. And clearly the reason, one of the economic reasons for that was somebody decided that mothers with young children ought to be home taking care of them, and so they sort of built that into the system. And that's evidenced in some of the congressional records regarding the debate of some of these family assistance plans and aid to families with dependent children and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, that clearly came out in the debate. Whether it's better to have those mothers working, I don't know. Whole another kind of ballgame. But regardless, you know, discrimination is clearly one of the causes of poverty, at least in an economic sense. And then the third reason for poverty, at least economically speaking, is that poverty, the number of poor people, is definitely affected by the overall level of economic activity. That is, poverty is a function of the business cycle. We can clearly show that when unemployment rate goes down, there are less poor people around. When unemployment goes up, we have more poor people around. the empirical evidence is fairly clear on this. Even union rules, to some extent, reinforces this, because most unions have this notion of last hired, first fired, you know, type of a thing. So the minute that the level of overall aggregate demand or the level of economic activity goes down, that is, when business starts slowing down, you know, those with low productivity, those with low skills, the poor people are the first to be laid off and so on. So the level of economic activity has clearly a big impact on the level of poverty. And we'll talk a little bit more about that level of economic activity tomorrow. Okay, and then there's a fourth economic reason, and some people are going to say, oh, this doesn't amount to much, and I'm not sure it does either. But as I was thinking through this, and probably the reason why I thought about it was the fact that I was here at Holden. Okay, there are many poor who are poor by choice. You know, and somebody's going to say, nah. Yeah, that's not true. But there must be some people at Holden who are volunteers working here, okay, who may work here for, say, 6 months or maybe even more, and then go back to a job in the cities for 3 months, and in that three-month period earn less than $5,000, and hence they will be counted in the income statistics or in the population data as being poor that year, you know. Now, I don't know how many people there are like that, but there's sort of some evidence that there are enough people at Holden, in the Peace Corps, people who live on marginal farms, who prefer to live on marginal farms, people who live in communal types of arrangements and so on, that it amounts to something around 5, 6, 7% of the poor are the sort of the figures I have seen. Yeah.
I live in Upper Michigan, and we have a 19% rate of unemployment, statistically. But I would say at least 5% of that is intentional unemployment of people who left good-paying jobs from Detroit, Lower Michigan, came up, bought a trailer home, live on next to nothing, but they choose to live that way. And, you know, has an impact upon our area because they also have need for public services and so on, but yes, don't contribute or expect to contribute to the over economic well-being or the machinery of the Upper Michigan.
Yeah, so you clearly get, you know, you clearly get that kind of poor. And it isn't, and that's not the poor that we're really worried about. The poor that we're worried about are the ones that are discriminated against, the ones with low productivity, and the ones that are then continually affected sort of by the business cycle. Now, now, what about government relief programs? relief programs have proliferated since the Depression. You know, we've had two time periods in our recent history when we've had a tremendous spurt of government relief programs. Depression, 1930s, when we had the Social Security Act and all the sort of the programs that came out of that. The New Deal. Then we sputtered along with remnants of the New Deal through the 50s. And we had relative affluence in the 1940s and 1950s in this country. So we didn't really have to worry about unemployment and poverty so much. Well, we still had it, but it wasn't as visible. And then we came along in the 1960s with Kennedy's New Frontier, with Johnson's War on Poverty. Was it Nixon's Great Society, or was that? But that was still Johnson's Great Society. I can't remember what Nixon called his. You know,
Watergate.
Watergate. Yeah. he had sort of a clever name anyway for a slogan. You know, for his society too. Peace and prosperity. But anyway, we had a proliferation of programs in the 1960s. Partly due to the affluence of the country. It's probable that the United States is much more sort of beneficially oriented when we are wealthy, when we're well off. We do give more poverty types of, we tend to pass more laws, more legislation, we tend to be much more lenient with our poor when we have more. You know, the minute it starts hurting our pocketbook, you know, then we really kind of cut back. But what are the economic reasons for government relief programs? That's really what I'm interested in. One economic reason is very, very self-serving, and perhaps two, you know, that is, communities can benefit by having housing assistance. Communities, and we, the middle class and upper class, can benefit by having sort of income supplemental types of programs, food plans and so on, because it keeps our property values up, okay? It, for instance, reduces crime. You know, there's a direct correlation between poverty, low or high unemployment, and crime, you know. So all of these things that we, the middle class people, value, that is peace, nice, neat neighborhoods, quiet, low crime rate, all of those things are to some extent alleviated when we have less poverty. So why not give a little bit to reduce the level of poverty, because it will only, generally speaking, help us more, you know, by keeping our property values up, by keeping crime out of our neighborhoods, all that sort of stuff. It may even cause us to spend less of our own money, okay, and we may become wealthier or be at least a little bit richer as a result of that, because we don't have to pay for our own fences, we don't have to buy our own guns, you know, we don't have to buy our own locks, that sort of stuff. So there is some very selfish economic reasons then for relieving poverty. There's also another economic reason which is sort of very selfish in its intention, at least as we see it, and that is there is a rich and an upper class, an upper middle class, who would like to see poverty eliminated. You know, we tend not to want to see poor people. And so we would pay, these people in this upper class, we'd really pay to eliminate this poverty. But it's expensive. And so we decide, hey, instead of paying for all of that ourselves, why don't we see if we can sucker all the rest of the people in on this, you know, helping us pay to eliminate this, and do it through the government. You know, have tax structures and have the government pay for welfare. That way, some of the lower middle class and some of the lower class people will also help us pay and eliminate this poverty, which we'd like to do. Some people say that that's the motivation of the intelligentsia, the liberal rich. You know, it soothes their conscience to eliminate poverty, but they'd rather not pay for all of it themselves out of their own pockets, and so they get all of the rest of us in on this hoax. I better not say hoax, but they get all of us in helping to pay for what they would like to have eliminated. Okay, so those are some economic reasons for the some selfish economic reasons for the existence of welfare types of programs. What about redistribution of income as a moral imperative? Okay. All of the other reasons that I mentioned sort of suggested selfishness and efficiency reasons. But what about, aren't there any kinds, isn't there a moral imperative to help the poor? It turns out that we really have not, or we probably do not still, have good social justice programs, that we don't have a good theory of social justice. We don't have good philosophical reasons for eliminating poverty. Most people who want to genuinely help eliminate poverty simply have to assert that they want to help eliminate poverty. About the best they can do is point to certain biblical phrases. You know, they can go to the Bible and say, in the Bible it says that we ought to help people. In the Quran it says that we ought to help people. But we don't have a constructed social justice, economic theory for it. It's just plain out assertion. At least in the Lutheran Church, we don't have a good theory. There doesn't seem to me that we do. We just simply assert that it says in the Bible that we ought to help other people, and I'm not sure that's theoretical enough, or that's that provides a structure or a framework for our poverty types of programs. But very recently, a social philosopher from Harvard by the name of John Rawls, and I don't know how many of you have read Rawls's stuff. It's a heavy, heavy book. I've gotten to page 12 about three times and fallen asleep trying to read it. It's excruciatingly heavy. One of these days I'm going to get through it. But I did find a summary of his book, which John Rawls wrote. It was called A Kantian Conception of Equality, and it's in a Cambridge Review. Some of you might really be interested in reading this. It's February 1975, issue of the Cambridge Review, and it's really an excellent article on social justice. Now, I don't want to go into an extensive discussion on Rawlsian justice. That's a whole nother forum. But basically what Rawls says that a just income distribution is one that's advantageous to everyone. You know, that's and an unjust income distribution is one that's not advantageous to everyone, you know, sort of a very circuitous kind of an argument there. But what most people have done, they have taken this Rawlsian theory of justice, of social justice, and said that that's clear evidence that what we need in this country is a massive redistribution of income. You know, take from the poor, take from the rich, take from the rich and give to the poor. And that would be social justice. You know, some people have started to counter this. Would that really be social justice? You know, if you take from the rich, what's very apt to happen? Well, if you take from the rich, isn't it possible that you could take away so much from the rich, you reduce their productive assets? Okay, the rich, you know, and I could never prove this, but isn't it the fact that the rich, you know, use their money to produce income, to produce more wealth, to produce more output? Okay, and one of the reasons why we have any redistribution at all is because those assets are being used to produce more, to continually enlarge our pot. You know, so some people have suggested that if you redistribute too much, if you take too much away from the rich and give it to the poor, in the long run, you're going to end up with less to redistribute from, less to share with. Okay, I'm not sure. Did I get that point across? Okay. You can use that then, if you want to, as justification for not redistributing anything. For sort of, you know, the wealthy could use that for keeping what they have, saying that they will just, you know, I'll keep what I have and keep working with that and keep enlarging the pie. And as a result of my natural ability, my ability to produce more, okay, we can make the rich or we can make the poor share more. You know, it's sort of like saying the piece of the pie that the poor get will remain, relatively speaking, will remain the same, but the size of it in absolute terms will increase. Okay, 10% of 100 is significantly more than 10% of 50, you know. So it keeps the relative structure the same, but in absolute terms, the poor are helped a little bit by it, you know. So there's a danger here, that we can take this Rawlsian theory of justice and use it to completely mismanage our redistribution system. And there's a raging debate now in at least among certain academicians, probably, you know, a bunch of philosophers, economists, and theologians. We've had a couple of forums on this at our university on Rawlsian justice and whether or not we should use that as the basis for our redistributional types of schemes and so on.
Yeah, is that one general critique of or criticism of a socialistic economic system? That danger is very real for...
You kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
But I mean, they apply that to socialism as an economic system and apply that argument. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think that's what I'm saying, or at least I guess I'm not just sure what you're saying or asking me.
I mean, when we're talking about, you know, economic distribution of income, obviously one alternative to what we're dealing with is at least a more socialistic economic outlook. You say we've got this input from our faith that says we need to do this, period, throughout a few Bible passages.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but there's no, I think you said, economic theory or structure developed along with that.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I don't think the Bible provides that anyway, but,
no.
You know, looking at to socialism or some aspects of it, democratic socialism in particular, as a possibility, what I'm saying is this argument that you just brought up, would that be used as a possible argument or criticism again, looking to a socialist economic structure to meet this?
Yeah. Yeah, I could see where that could be used for that.
Are there specific authors or economists that promote this per se, that you know? Besides Goldwater, I mean.
let me look up some of my sources on this, but there are some, I think you could go right to Rawls, and then there are two people that have very extensively countered Rawls. You know, as a matter of fact, I think both of them are from Harvard. So I could just imagine the philosophy department at Harvard in a tremendous upheaval and uproar, because there's a big argument going on between two of the biggest philosophers they have out there. So
it's a very convenient argument for the rich.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very, very, very nice.
Even though the piece of the pie stays the same proportion, but gets bigger for the poor, you realize it gets bigger for the rich, too.
Yeah. We've been able to appease the world for quite some time with that. You know, capitalism has done that. You know, it's the reason why we didn't have tremendous upheavals and sort of wars of redistribution earlier is because of our tremendous success productivity-wise. That is, we were able to increase output so fast, you know, that even the poor got more from year to year, and they clearly could see that they got more. You know. Then all of a sudden, somebody started looking around. You know, I think it probably happened when we got television and better communication and so on. Hey, you know, I may have more, but relative to somebody else, I have less. You know, when people became aware of that, we started getting more problems with our distributional system.
Well, whenever something like this comes up in discussion or what should we do in Christian response, this problem of motivation, that losing motivation within the economic system is always a key issue. And it seems to me that part of the problem is that we try and change the structure before we try and change the values. What ends up happening is we retain the values that go along with the current structure, you know, of continued growth, of accumulating wealth, of material goods, and then we think that we ought to alter the structure to redistribute the wealth, which in the end is going to affect the accumulation of goods and all of those things. And so we try or it's been attempted to try and change the structure, but the value's not changed, so people are dissatisfied and are still desiring the things which the old system gave them.
It's probably easier to change the sort of the economic structure than it is to change values and attitudes.
Because you could keep the productivity up if people's values weren't based on material worth of what they were doing.
But I've heard a powerful case made on the basis of Christian theology, namely our fundamental belief in the fall and the sinful nature of mankind. Capitalism is the best system that we've devised that takes into account the human creature, and that we as Christians ought to realize, of all people, that people are by nature sinful and unclean, and that capitalism is merely a system that utilizes and redirects that kind of inherent sinfulness of people. I mean, this is serious, the kind of presentation that was made. So that capitalism is the best system, using sinful people, that basically expands the pot, and that then as Christians we try to help see that everybody gets a certain measure of that. I think the real tension is,
Can we talk about equality and excellence and put those two together? Is that there's a fundamental difference in our society. We use those as both values we emulate, to be excellent, to be first, to achieve. But somehow when you talk about excellence, you can't talk about everybody being at the same level of excellence. And our society awards the excellence.
Is there something about means justifying the ends in what you're suggesting? And that's the one thing I would ask. And then also, I guess I would wonder about, you said best. You said capitalism is best in
comparison to other social systems or political systems or economic. This is the argument that I heard that was...
In terms of production, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, that's kind of fatalistic, it's assuming that you can't develop...
Exactly.
I must choose one that we already have.
That's right. But the fact is, it's been around, and what have we devised in the history of mankind? Now, everybody's been trying to create new things. Marxism was the latest, but it's been around for 50 years, and what has it done?
Well, it's created a political structure under which 80% of the population of the world probably exists, I think it's roughly speaking 80% of the world. Capitalism is lonely in the world. There are more socialistic societies, more Marxist even probably than capitalistic societies, and I don't know that we can say that capitalism is more successful than socialism. The evidence is not at all clear. I would maintain that probably capitalistic societies have better production, and that socialistic societies may have better distribution. You know, so maybe in the near future, if there ever is some kind of convergence of the two, maybe we ought to take the best of the two, you know, as our system evolves.
And distribution of income, you mean? They have a better distribution.
Yeah.
Better in that sense, equal. To me, it seems that reduced to an equality of poverty.
I guess my assumption is better is more equal. Yeah. You know, I should have mentioned that. And of course, now you're using this counter-Rawlsian type of argument that, if we make the pie bigger, we can justify relative poverty based on the fact that we can make the pie bigger and even the poor can have a little bit more than they had last year, you know. Any other? Well, let me just... briefly mention some of the methods that we have of redistribution, and then maybe you can begin to reflect into the methods some of your what we in economics call utility functions or preferences, maybe. One way we have a redistributing income is through in-kind kind of transfer types of programs. That is, you know, you don't want to trust anybody with cash. Especially the poor, so you give them in kind, you know, and the best example of in kind is the stamp program, where poor people are allowed to buy stamps based on the income they have and the size of their families. That is, the price of the stamps are determined by the size of your family and the level of income of your family. So the lower your income and the bigger your family, you know, the cheaper or the lower price you pay for the food. You know, the price of the stamp then is some price below the redemption value of the stamp. So you can go in and you can buy a dollar stamp that's worth a dollar in a grocery store. If you have a small family and say your income is $4,000, you may have to pay 75 cents for a dollar coupon, okay, for a food stamp. If you have a large family and low income, you may have to pay 50 cents or 25 cents. For that same stamp. No.
And that's been modified somewhat, I think, essentially what you say. Now the stamps are all free now, except you get more stamps if you've got a lower income and less stamps if you get.
Are they completely free in every case?
Yes.
And when did that happen?
They don't pay anything now.
It's proportion to the size of your family, though. You get more stamps.
Okay, yeah.
I think it's still expensive.
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. I wasn't aware of that. This is Okay, now, there are some sort of... what essentially happens then is that food stamps lower the price of food for poor families, and the poorer you are, the lower the price of food becomes. Now, as an economist, I have some problem with that, because what that does, I think, is it takes sort of the social welfare function or my social preferences, and it imposes it on a group of people. You know, in other words, I want then, what I'm saying is, I want you to have food, you know, and food becomes relatively so inexpensive for these people that they use, that they buy more food than they should have. You know, the opposite is, if instead of giving out food stamps, we gave people cash, for instance, an individual would spend a third of that, perhaps, or half of that cash on food and there's some on entertainment and some of the other sort of amenities of life, you know. But what we are forcing on these people by giving food stamps, we're forcing them to spend probably 90% of their income on food. And so they overconsume food and underconsume some of the other things that perhaps are part of the good life. It's almost like we don't trust you with money, okay, because we know what's good for you. We know that if we give you money, you'll spend it on booze, broads, and cigarettes, you know, that sort of stuff. we aren't saying that, but that's really what we're doing, because we're making the food so inexpensive that they can't afford to pass it up. And so consequently, what you see in the marketplace now is a black market developed with food stamps. You know, people are selling food stamps for cash, okay, at below par value, okay, in an attempt to get some money to use for some of these other things. And some of that is undoubtedly spent on booze and broads and cigarettes, you know. But some of it is spent on some of the other things in life. And I say that's the middle class mentality, sort of telling the people, you know, what what they ought to do, what's good for them, you know, rather than allowing people to make decisions. The same thing holds for housing. You know, housing is another way of redistributing income. You know, if you're very poor, you have the chance to get low income housing. You know, significant things that have resulted from low-income housing is that we use the economic argument that it's cheaper per occupancy unit. We build large, huge projects. You know, that is, if you build a block-long building, you know, or half a block wide, and put about 600 apartments into it, that's cheaper than this building small units, spreading them throughout the city, you know. So we use sort of an economic efficiency argument as justification for putting up these huge projects, which invariably seem to turn into tomorrow's ghettos. And the other thing that it does, it very niftily, for our sort of middle-class communities, segregates minorities, you know. It keeps them out of our areas. You know, how many of you have gone along the highway in Chicago is a clear case, you know. My gosh, there are miles of these huge buildings containing, you know, some phenomenal percentage of the poor population of Chicago. How better to segregate them, you know? School systems have been accused of using low-income housing projects to segregate, you know, and I think that's one of the things we have done. There's this whole notion of education. A radical economist would say that the educational system is a hoax. That is, it's the capitalist has sort of decided that they need people to work in a capitalistic system to fit into a certain mold. You know, we want productive workers who are well trained, who are punctual, who can get along well with other people, have all of these affective attributes that we'd like nice people to have, you know, be clean, washed, you know, use deodorant and all that sort of stuff. And that we teach people in the schools, you know. It would be tremendously expensive for the capitalists to establish their own training programs to do that for all of us, you know. And so, as a matter of fact, they probably, capitalists couldn't afford to do that. And so they make us pay for our own training by paying taxes for what we call free education. It ain't free. You know, it's a tremendously expensive system that we pay for. What tends to happen in this educational system, which is one way now we say of we redistribute income through education. Jesse Jackson says that. I think Jesse Jackson forgot to look at the educational system and what it really does, because I think what the educational system really does is, with the exception of a few programs for the very bright and a few programs for the very slow, everything moves along at a pretty average pace in the educational system, right? Okay. There's you know, for the majority of us, when we went through that educational process, there was no difference between your education and my education and your education and your education. By and large, it was the same. Okay. Therefore, what we get out of that system depends more on the abilities that we have and the motivation that we have when we're in the mill. Okay. And it's clear that the upper classes and the middle classes have at least more motivation because their role models are differently. Okay? So they get more out of the system. And so the educational system, instead of being a redistributive tool, really does the opposite. It widens the gap between the haves and the have-nots. Some people contend that, and if you look at the outcome, you know, that may very well be the case. As a matter of fact, what we do is we prevent certain poor from taking advantage of higher education because we put the entrance requirement into higher education so high that there's no way they can meet the standards. Okay. Now, we've tried to overcome that to some extent in the last few years, but nevertheless, we have that kind of thing.
So we started to play some games with that too, I think, by setting up these city colleges and community colleges for the poor. And it's interesting, we had at Rotary Club here a couple of weeks ago a fellow from Waubonsee College, a community college near us, and he was telling us of the training programs that they now carry out for Caterpillar, teaching like welding, for instance. They come to Waubonsee College and they say to Waubonsee College, we want welders, okay, certain kind of welders. They then provide the equipment to do it with, but the school provides the instructors and goes through the process. Then when they're done, then they go to Caterpillar. Then the question was asked, do you teach them anything but welding? That is, do you teach them any other skill in the event that that job would dry up? No.
Yeah. What would you do if you were Caterpillar in that situation? Boy, I would go to that school and I would say, I need 2,000 welders. And so you train 2,000 welders when you maybe have 500 jobs. Okay. And what happens? When the supply exceeds demand, the price of welders go down. Yeah.
And they're winning.
That's a tremendous deal for Caterpillar.
Yeah, that's
and
what I'm saying.
It's really a hoax when we can pull that sort of stuff off. Sure.
The mandate of the school is that apparently, you know, under its charter now, is that in the event that there are 12 people who seek or want a certain kind of training, the school must provide it.
Well, I just wanted to say there are other people that hire welders besides Caterpillar, and if there's an oversupply in that school district, I think there's a certain amount of mobility among the people. I don't like to hear you describe junior college as playing games, because I come from the state where the whole system was invented, and I think it's a pretty good system. I like the junior college system. It's one way to beat the thing that Jan is talking about, this high cost of education for the poor. It's providing good technological education. In a lot of cases, it's also providing a leg up for a further academic education for the guy whose high school grades are not so great.
One way it has covered is by clustering it, beginning both tech education of careers.
In other words, you may train for welding, but simultaneously you train them for a number of other related occupations.
Well, that's what I asked, though. That was the question. I'm not opposed to community college. I think they're great in many ways, but it blew my mind when he said that Caterpillar could come to them and ask them to train X number of welders. They train X number of welders. They said, do you train them for anything else or teach them any of the other courses, like English or math or anything? Only insofar as it's related to that task, he said. And then they are released and Caterpillar hires them and they're gone. The point is, when that welding job dries up, then what? And I'm committed to, you know, I think we need some liberal arts and stuff in there besides just technical things, like reading. Yeah. You know, a lot of these people can't read.
A lot of that's there, though, and sure, this sort of thing happens in California, too, exactly what you're describing, but the opportunities are there, and you'd be amazed at how these people do take advantage of those opportunities, yeah. Because they are there, and the cost is very little greater on them to go ahead and take them.
Yeah. But he also pointed out things like CETA training, I guess that's is that right?
Yeah.
CETA helps train people to do jobs. They'll help pay the expense for that and provide transportation. And he was indicating to me, and I don't know, you know, whether I like it or don't like it or what, you know, but talking about the poor, you know, the hardest task is to get them to the place to train them. See what I mean? And they're willing to pay the price, and I think that's great. They'll go out and seek them out and, you know, try to wake them up if they have to with the bus and get them going again. But it's really a problematic situation.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, so we've done, you know, we've have the food stamp program, we have housing programs, we have educational programs, we have minimum wage programs. You know, those are all income redistribution types of programs in the end, in an attempt to help. Now, has it worked? You know, let me present that. Has any of this done a bit of good? Let me present to you. You know, rent controls is another, you know, kind of thing. It just about ruined New York City, rent control. And rent control was a redistribution program to help people. You know, look what happened in New York City under rent control. What happened? The rents were so low that the people couldn't maintain the buildings. When the buildings weren't maintained, the people who could afford to pay the rent got discouraged because, you know, property was just deteriorating, so they moved out, and who moved in but low-income people, and who for, you know, for them, this was the only thing they could afford, you know. And what happened to New York City? You know, all the wealthy people, all the middle-income people, not all of them, but a lot of them moved out, poor people moved in, and what happens was that the tax base in New York City eroded and the welfare base rose, you know. And then that was another kind of redistribution program that we've had. Let me show you the income distribution for 1952, 62, 72, and 75. Okay, and what we typically do with this is sort of divided into fifths. So that would be quintiles, wouldn't it? You know, in other words, the lowest 20%, the second 20%, the third 20%, the fourth 20%, and the highest 20%. Does that make sense? In other words, 20% of the population has so much of the income in the country. The next 20%, between 20 and 40%, has so much. Mm-hmm. And then the next between 40 and 60 have so much, you know. Okay? Okay, in other words, to have total equality, in other words, the first percent would have the same as the 25th percent, as the 50th percent, as the 75th percent, and so on. You know, all the income would be divided equally that way, you know. And that's hardly possible, you know. That would never work. But let me tell you what has happened. Okay, in 1952, the lowest fifth, the 20% of the population, the poorest 20% of the population, had 4.9% of the income. Okay, 20% were living on 4.9% of the income. In 62, that changed to 5%. In 72, it changed to 5.4%, and in 75, it was 5.4%. Okay. The second fifth, you know, in other words, the 40 percentile from 20 to 40%. In 52, they had 12.2%. 62, they had 12.1%. 72, they had 11.9%. 75, they had 11.8%. No change. The middle fifth, 17.1 in 52, 17.6 in 62, 17.5 in 72, 17.6 in 75. No change. Hardly, you know. The fourth fifth, 23.5, 24, 23.9, 24.1. You know, no change. No perceptible change. The highest, these are the 20 wealthiest 20% of the country in terms of income. 42% of the income in 1952, 20%, the richest 20% had 42% of the income. Okay, in 52. They had 41.3% in 62, 41.4% in 72, 41.1% in 75. Virtually unchanged.
There was one small trend, probably wasn't significant. It looked like the only real exchange that occurred is in the lowest two-fifths there. There was a slight increase in lowest fifths and a slight decrease in the second fifth.
Yeah.
40%. So it looked like the second fifth contributed to the lowest fifth.
That's, yeah, that's exactly what happened, because that one went from 4.9 to 5.4, and the second fifth dropped from 12.2 to 11.8.
Yeah.
So then it's probable that the not so poor helped the very,
very poor.
And
how do you handle this? I don't know your numbers, but I'm sure that my father was in the second 20%, and I'm now in the top 20%. Now, how do you handle that one?
Yeah, there are compositional changes. That's what you're suggesting, that some people, but that's going to happen. But when you moved from whatever you moved into something else, that means somebody else had to move down.
But
the problem is still there.
Otherwise, there's a tendency to think that the top 20% have kept the bottom 20% in their place all that time. And I'm at least one person who will say, I know there's movement.
Oh, between the classes?
Yeah.
But see, that doesn't eliminate the fact that...
I understand. I'm just trying to temper that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sure there are people that can go from the bottom 20% to the top 20% in that
country. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, that rags to riches story, you know, which is, sort of the American dream. Well, okay, but even moving from the bottom to the top, that probably ain't so true, you know. It's for some people, for the poor, you know.
I think maybe from 72 to 92 is going to be a bit more difficult than it was from 42 to 72. I'll accept that.
Mm-hmm.
But that also has something to do with the limitations of the United States as a place to produce.
Yeah. I guess what bothers me, to sort of summarize, is that we have all these redistribution programs, and it doesn't seem like they've done any good. You know that, and we've gone through tremendous numbers of years and hundreds of programs with seemingly no effect.
There's really tremendous resistance.